Good afternoon. I don't have slides, so don't be looking for them. They're not there. As I was preparing this presentation, it occurred to me how closely intertwined with my own professional and academic paths are with the two wars which have been fought over the past decade. I was 3 weeks into my first semester as a new faculty member when 9/11 occurred, and my first presentation at APHA was with a couple of colleagues from UIC a few years later, in which we talked about organizing a teach-in after the onset of the war in Iraq. Subsequent presentations at this annual meeting between then and now have included responses to editorials I wrote inviting public health nurses to resist cooperation with warfare, a performance text giving voice to the lament of a mother from military families speak out, describing her anguish over her son's repeated deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan, and a description of a trip I took a few years later to Nicaragua on behalf of Emergency, an international humanitarian organization providing health care services to civilian victims of war. So these wars have been, among many other things, a great clarifier. They have helped me hone my understanding of what it means to be a mother and a woman of the 21st century, what it means to try to live a life of thoughtful integrity, and most relevant to our discussion today, what it means not only to be a nurse, but to claim the honor and tradition of public health nursing. The title of this presentation is Public Health Nursing in the Military, the Ethical Implications of Alliance. Its catalyst was the publication last year of an article in Advances in Nursing Science, which examined the incursion of military influence, terminology, and funding into nursing education and research. Its authors included three Canadians and an Australian, namely Emily Perrone, Anne-Marie Rice, David Holmes, and Trudy Rudge, respectively. Their critique and their identification by name of the University of Tennessee's program on Homeland Security Nursing prompted an indignant response from the director of that program, who not only questions the validity of the author's argument, but also their ethics in outing, which is my term and not hers, the school itself. The editor of Advances in Nursing Science, Peggy Chin, responded in turn by inviting reactions from three different sources. Two faculty members from the Auckland University of Technology in New Zealand, one of whom included a nurse, a response from a writer identified as an editorial consultant, and one from me, a faculty member of the College of Nursing at UIC. Not included among the published responses was another rebuttal of the original article by Deborah Purcell, who was one of the first graduates of the University of Tennessee's program and is the current coordinator of the Arkansas State University Regional Center for Disaster Preparedness Education. Copies of all the articles as well as the responses are on the back table there. While the flying sparks of professional controversy catch our attention, especially within an academic discipline not known necessarily for its fiery Socratic debates, there is more at stake here than a war of words which ensues from clashing worldviews. Clearly, Perrone et al. View the embedding of military thought, language, and influence within nursing as a threat, one that, in their words, creates a context of uncertainty, fear, and crisis, where nursing is co-opted and used to further a particular political agenda. Conversely, Spira defends her program as pioneering, preparing nursing scholars and clinicians with advanced skills who can lead in practice during calamity, wherever it may be, responding to the needs of our 21st century. The extent to which we agree with the one or the other depends to a large extent on our own political perspective and our response to the events since 9/11. What remains incontrovertible, however, is that we are being asked to define where we stand as nurses in the 21st century, during which war has become routinized and baseline. What sort of mandate, if any, do we have from our history and tradition of public health nursing which can help us to frame a response? As teaching faculty within a large urban university and as a professor housed within the public health department of the College of Nursing, this question presents itself on a regular basis. Each year, I look out on a sea of new undergraduate students who have lived longer and longer portions of their life with war as a fixed backdrop. A 20-year-old junior has lived half of her life in the shadow of war. Every year, more of our students are either active military reservists or veterans, and they come to us with increasingly complex problems and issues. So when I teach the history of nursing, attempt to help them understand that the evolution of professional nursing has been shaped by the odd bedfellows who conceived it, the military and the religious. I am speaking to a growing percentage of individuals who come to nursing already strongly conditioned to a life of service that includes unquestioning obedience, strict discipline, uniformity, and a willingness to be subordinated. In the face of this, how do we teach autonomy, the ethical mandate to question, the importance of assuming one's own identity with attendant values and morals? Question authority, advises the popular bumper sticker. How do we convey the wisdom of that aphorism to students coming from a tradition of military authoritarianism about to enter a healthcare culture still rife with remnants of our own caste system? Similarly, I have sat in countless meetings within my own subspecialty of public health nursing in which we drone on and on about the difficulty of defining public health nursing, population-focused nursing, community-based nursing, and how can we improve our image, spiff it up, make it a recognizable brand. Given enough time to the meeting, eventually someone will reframe it. Exactly what is it that nursing, public health nursing, population-based nursing, community-based nursing, brings to the table? I would suggest and invite your consideration that we bring nothing of substance unless we have the courage to address the fundamental questions raised by the controversy sparked within the pages of ANS. What is the proper response of nursing to a culture in which war has become routinized, accustomed to a society in which it is baseline? Do we collude so that we can cash in on the spoils, or do we resist? Or something in between, or nothing at all? How do our actions, or lack of them, define the mandate of our practice, our educational mission, and our place within the history of public health nursing? So let me attempt very briefly to summarize a few of the more cogent issues raised in the article by Perrone et al., to acknowledge the salient objections posed by Spira, and consider how that they might impact upon the direction of nursing practice and education. First of all, they situate the discussion in a particular point of time, the post-9/11 decade. As mentioned, the relationship between nursing and the military has deep roots. Wars highlight the importance of skilled nursing care, and nurses gain public esteem and recognition from battlefield duty. Our hierarchical authority structure and our terminology itself reflect our dependence on the military model from which we arose in part. But that is not the critical issue here. What the authors argue is that the influence wielded by the military since 9/11 has dramatically transformed the scholarship, research, education, and practice of nurses. And I quote, "Nursing has seen a proliferation of literature on the subject of health intervention in context of terrorism, war, and public health crises since 9/11. Literature searches turn up an abundance of publications that focus on disaster nursing, biosecurity, terrorism, emerging preparedness, homeland security, and mass casualty management. This phenomenon is particularly evident in the U.S., but it is also observed in Canada, Australia, the U.K., as well as other countries." Secondly, the authors make clear that they recognize the necessity of skilled nursing intervention in scenarios where natural or man-made disasters have led to multiple injuries and public health emergencies. What they object to is a sort of passive acceptance of the radical transformation of Western power structures in a post-9/11 world. What they describe as the plethora of commission reports, investigations, security policies and procedures, information collection, management guidelines, and public surveillance schemas have contributed to an environment of mistrust and increased anxiety, and have overtly or covertly distracted public health practitioners from their traditional mission of health promotion and response to social justice and human rights violations. They recognize that prevention of terrorism and its health consequences should be in curricula of schools of public health, medicine, nursing, and other public health fields and disciplines, But the prevention of terrorism, and this is my point and not theirs, goes beyond anthrax detection and collaboration with Homeland Security, Homeland Security officials. It also includes an honest discussion on the ethics of our country's terrorist prevention strategies. The widespread use of drones, for example, which results increasingly in the senseless death of civilians, including women and children. The authors recognize the potency of language and the subtle and not so subtle incursion of military jargon into the nursing lexicon and by extension into our curriculum. Terms such as mass casualty, impact, rapid maneuvers of forces, disaster planning and management, lines of command, large-scale operations, deployment of personnel, and tactical planning are becoming more prominent, even routine, and they suggest a shift in the way nurses situate themselves, their practice, and their clients within the discursive framework of war, security, and terrorism. What proved to be a lightning rod of contention for some readers of ANS was the naming of the University of Tennessee's program on Homeland Security nursing as an illustration of, and I quote, a dangerous blurring of aims and purposes, end quote, in which courses are taught not only by nursing faculty, but also by personnel from agencies such as the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, and private corporations such as Population Health Surveillance Laboratories. The existence of such programs, in the author's view, increases the risk of the erosion of nurses' capacity to make autonomous decisions and to challenge current health policies, given the overwhelming influence of security and the war on terror. As partial remedy to such erosion, the authors propose the widespread adoption of critical pedagogical methodology in nursing education. According to them, such a practice seeks to engage students in reflective dialogue to analyze systems of oppression and domination that create inequities among social groups. Questions engendered by such an approach might include some of the following. What is the construct of health and illness change within the growing influence of certain organizations, such as military and healthcare? How are nurses' subjectivities constructed in narratives of war and disaster? How is nursing situated and portrayed in war efforts? How is knowledge produced? What kind of knowledge is produced and for what purpose? How do nurses reconcile nursing principles with pro-war endeavors? What is the meaning of care in this context? The meaning of ethics? What does it mean to be autonomous and reflective in this context? And how is the political agenda defined, embodied, and enacted? Such an approach could be particularly effective with students who have come to age in an era of chronic and debilitating warfare. Included in the handouts, which I mentioned on the back table, is Dr. Spiro's response to the article, so you can read it in its entirety. But to briefly summarize her objections, as noted, she felt that the naming of the school and its program constituted a primal attack replete with violent and incendiary language. She also defended the purpose of her program as the production of disaster nursing leaders prepared to function in a global society. She goes on to delineate the skills with which they are prepared, including how to cope when the values, orientations of the nurse are in conflict with those of the society in which she provides care. And so I conclude with the oft-asked question of what is the unique perspective public health nursing brings to the table. While we are yet to craft the perfect answer, the discussions such as the one found in the pages of ANS, even when rancorous, bring us closer to a definitive understanding of what is uniquely ours. Engaging in such critical dialogue within our scholarly journals and encouraging our students to think and question both the status quo and authority are also of essential importance. If we remain silent in the debates which clarify our moment in time, we bring nothing to the table. Vera Brittain, World War I nurse and author of How War Affects Women, put it this way. If women are indifferent, if they remain politically non-conscious, if, in brief, they choose not to choose, then they are directly, but nonetheless certainly, assisting those forces which are pushing civilization towards chaos. Lillian Wald offered this view. The final abolition of war and the establishment of permanent peace must depend on the convictions of men and women who are equally responsible, and I would add, responsive. So the controversy engendered within the pages of ANS helped shake us from our torpor. Peggy Chin did the academic world of nursing a service in publishing not only the original article, but also the responses. In reflecting upon the issues raised, we hone our own understanding of what it means to be a human being, a nurse, a public health nurse, at this moment in time. And so we strive to rise above indifference, to speak to our convictions, and when appropriate, to take to the streets. Were she still among us today, we can only imagine which Occupy Wall Street encampment Miss Lavinia Lloyd Dock might choose to join. Thank you.